Katra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. How do we really judge the value of an idea? Or maybe a really personal experience?
Yeah, is it worth just about where it came from, its origins?
Or is it about what it actually does for us? You know, the impact it has on our lives right now?
That's a huge question. Really challenges how we think about truth itself.
Welcome to The Deep Dive. Today we're diving into a truly revolutionary book that tackles exactly this. William James's The Varieties of Religious Experience.
And our goal here is basically to give you a shortcut, a clear path to understanding James's incredible insights into human spirituality.
We're going to explore how he moved past the usual arguments, you know, dogma on one side, pure skepticism on the other.
Right. And hopefully by the end, you'll feel well informed on this topic. It really can reshape how you see belief, consciousness, even the search for meaning.
Definitely. James himself, he was tackling a big problem of his time. Yeah, how do you seriously study these deeply subjective religious-type experiences, especially when scientific materials was becoming so dominant?
It's tricky. He didn't want to just dismiss them as, like, a brain glitch.
But he wasn't going to just accept Aaron Klain without question either.
Exactly. He was looking for that middle way, intellectually serious, but also deeply empathetic.
It's a tough balance.
Yeah.
Taking something so personal seriously without, you know, either rejecting it or just buying into everything.
That's the tightrope James walked. Absolutely.
Okay. So to understand how he managed that, we really need to understand the person. Who was William James? What made him the right person to write this book?
Well, William James, born 1842, was a huge figure in America. Philosopher, historian, psychologist. I mean, he really covered a lot of ground.
Often called the father of American psychology, right? Didn't he start the first experimental psych lab in the U.S.?
That's right, at Harvard. And what's so fascinating about James is his background. He trained as a medical doctor, taught anatomy, physiology, then moved into philosophy and this brand new field, psychology.
So he saw things from multiple angles, not just one perspective.
Precisely. He had this multifaceted lens for looking at the human experience.
And he wasn't just a scientist or doctor. He was also central to pragmatism in philosophy. How did that shape how he approached something like religious experience?
That's absolutely key. Pragmatism, which James really championed, basically says the meaning, the truth of an idea is found in its practical effects.
What it does.
Exactly. It's not about some abstract truth out there. It's about what difference the idea makes in practice. If it works, if it leads to good, tangible results in someone's life or in the world, well, then it has truth in a practical sense.
And that pragmatic test is the foundation for the varieties, isn't it?
It's the bedrock. It led him look at experiences based on their outcome, their usefulness, rather than trying to pin down their, you know, ultimate source or traditional justification.
And there was something else too, right? His own life. He wasn't just an academic observing from afar.
Not at all. James really struggled. He had serious bouts of depression, what he called an existential crisis, when he was younger.
Wow.
And that gave him this deep personal understanding of spiritual struggle, of inner turmoil, but also the potential for transformation. He got it.
So he was both sympathetic and critical.
Yes. That combination, the scientific mind, the philosophical framework, and that personal empathy, that's what makes varieties so compelling, so powerful.
Okay, so this unique background really set him up to challenge how we judge these deep experiences. And he starts the varieties with this really radical idea. Tell us about, forget the roots, what did he mean?
Right, so he was directly challenging something he called medical materialism. This was the common thinking back then.
Which was?
Basically, the idea that you could dismiss religious experiences simply by pointing to a physical cause. You know, oh, that saint's vision, that was just epilepsy, or that feeling of oneness, just weird brain chemistry.
Reducing it all down to biology.
Exactly. And Jit said, wait a minute, that's a logical mistake. A fallacy.
Oh, so?
Well, he pointed out that all our mental states, whether you're thinking scientifically, feeling love, or having a mystical vision, all of them have some kind of neurological basis in the brain.
Right. Your brain is involved when you think about anything.
Precisely. So if you dismiss religious feelings just because they have a physical correlate, you'd have to dismiss all thought on the same grounds. It just doesn't follow.
It's a dead end argument.
It is. And this is where his pragmatism comes roaring in. He said, forget the roots where it came from physiologically. Judge it by its fruits.
The results. The effects.
Yes. The tangible, observable effects it has on a person's life. Does it make their life better, more meaningful? Does it lead to more positive actions, more resilience?
That is radical, judging truth by outcome. But hang on a second. What about, say, a cult leader? Couldn't they argue their followers' lives are better by their own weird standards? Does James put any limits on what counts as good fruits?
That's a really fair question, and it's a classic challenge to pragmatism. James wasn't naive, though. While he focuses on the individual's experience, the implication is that genuinely positive fruits are things we generally recognize as, well, good.
Like
increased kindness, more charity, personal strength, resilience, inner peace, compassion, becoming a more integrated whole person. If an experience leads someone to be destructive or hateful or mentally falls apart, that wouldn't pass the test, even if the person claims it feels good initially.
Okay, so there's an implicit moral and psychological dimension to the fruits.
I think so. It's about its real world value, its cash value, as James famously put it. What good does it actually do in your life and how you interact with the world?
So it's this major shift away from where did it start to what does it achieve that really challenges how we normally think about what's true, doesn't it?
It really does.
And James didn't just talk about this stuff abstractly. He became this amazing collector, almost a curator of experiences. He gathered tons of firsthand accounts, saints, mystics, poets. Just ordinary people, too.
Yeah, the book is filled with these incredible stories.
So looking at all these diverse accounts, what did he find? Did patterns emerge in how people approach spirituality?
Oh, definitely. He saw patterns, and he grouped them into these two basic religious temperaments. First, you've got the healthy-minded.
Okay, what are they like?
These are the optimistic ones. They tend to see the good in things, they focus on the positive, and they often minimize or even seem to ignore evil and suffering.
I can picture that. Maybe like Walt Whitman. His poetry is just bursting with that kind of cosmic joy.
Perfect example. Or James mentions the mind cure movement, popular then very focused on positive thinking, the mind healing the body. For these folks, religion is often about gratitude, feeling connected, affirming life.
Makes sense. What's the other type?
The complete opposite, in a way. The sick soul.
The sick soul. That sounds intense.
It is. This temperament is sharply, sometimes agonizingly, aware of suffering, of evil, of injustice. They feel the brokenness of the world and often their own brokenness very deeply.
So, prone to melancholy. Maybe anxiety, existential dread.
Exactly. They see the world as fundamentally flawed, needing some kind of radical rescue or salvation.
You mentioned Tolstoy earlier, his confession. Or maybe John Bunyan, wrestling with his sins in Pilgrim's Progress.
Those are classic examples. And what's interesting is James doesn't pathologize the sick soul. He doesn't say it's wrong to feel that way.
Right. It's almost like he's saying that deep awareness of suffering isn't a failure. It could actually be the starting point for a profound change. Like your existential angst might be your superpower.
Ha. That's a great way to put it. Yeah. And for the sick soul, that profound change often comes through what James calls conversion.
Okay. What do you mean by conversion?
It's this psychological shift where a self that feels divided, unhappy, maybe torn, becomes unified, becomes whole.
Can it happen slowly or is it always dramatic?
It can be either. Gradual, slow integration, or sometimes sudden, like a flash of lightning. But what James found fascinating was how often people described it as something happening to them.
Not something they did.
Right, like their own will wasn't the main driver. It felt passive, suggesting the subconscious mind plays a huge role.
Okay, so he maps out these different temperaments, the path of conversion. But what about those really extreme experiences, the ones that seem almost impossible to describe? Mysticism.
He dives right into mysticism, doesn't shy away at all. In fact, you could argue it's kind of the intellectual core of the book in some ways.
Really? So what did he identify as the key features of these mystical states?
He pinpointed four main characteristics. First, they're ineffable.
Meaning
you can't really put them into words properly. The person knows what they experienced, but language just fails to capture it adequately for someone else.
Okay, what's second?
Second, and this was crucial for James, they have a noetic quality.
Noetic. Like knowledge.
Exactly. They aren't just feelings or emotions. They feel like states of knowing, providing deep insights into the nature of reality. It feels like a genuine revelation, utterly convincing to the person having the experience.
So more than just feeling good, it's a feeling of understanding something profound.
Precisely. Third, they are transient. They don't last long, maybe moments, maybe hours, brief, though the effects of the experience can last a lifetime.
Right. And the fourth?
Fourth is passivity. The mystic often feels like their own will is suspended, like they're being grasped or acted upon by some higher power rather than actively doing something themselves.
Ineffable, noetic, transient, passive.
Okay. And what's really fascinating, getting back to that noetic quality, James argues these aren't just, you know, subjective fantasies. He famously suggests that our normal everyday waking consciousness, it might not be the only kind there is.
What do you mean?
He wrote that famous line, something like, all around our normal consciousness, parted from it by the filmiest of screens, there lie potential forms of consciousness entirely different.
Wow. That's quite a thought. It opened things up incredibly.
It does. It implies that these mystical experiences, even if they don't prove anything to an outsider, are absolutely real and authoritative for the individual. And they strongly suggest reality might be much wider, much stranger than our everyday awareness lets on.
It makes you wonder. Imagine, just for a moment, you listening right now. Imagine having an experience that just completely flipped your view of reality. How would you even begin to process that, integrate it?
It's a profound question James forces us to confront.
So, okay, we've looked at roots versus fruits, the healthy-minded and sick souls, mystical insights. Let's bring it home. Why does reading about this book, this deep dive, matter for you listening today? What are the real-life takeaways?
Well, I think one huge thing is how it helps foster empathy and tolerance.
How so?
By understanding the psychological function of belief, why different kinds of people are drawn to different kinds of spirituality. It makes it harder to judge, doesn't it?
Yeah, you see why someone might need that quiet nature connection while someone else needs the drama of a conversion. It makes sense psychologically.
Exactly. It encourages a more pluralistic view. We're not all built the same way spiritually.
And personally, I think it's incredibly valuable for self-understanding. James basically normalizes doubt, despair, those existential crises.
He really does. He frames them not as failures, but as potential turning points, springboards for growth.
It gives you a language, a framework to understand your own inner struggles. Maybe see them not just as problems, but as part of a journey.
Mm-hmm. And it also offers a kind of third way for people maybe caught between rigid religion and stark scientific materialism.
Right. People who feel like there must be something more, but aren't comfortable with dogma.
James shows it's possible to be intellectually honest, scientifically informed, but still open to the spiritual dimension. It's about humility, really, knowing we don't know everything.
And then there's the most practical part, maybe, applying that judge by the fruits test to your own life.
Yes. Ask yourself, does this belief I hold, this practice I do, this community I'm part of, does it make me a better person?
More compassionate, more resilient, more integrated. Does it bring more love or purpose into my life and maybe through me into the world?
It's a very life-centered way to evaluate things, moving beyond abstract arguments to what actually works for human flourishing.
Yeah. James just had this deep, deep respect for the individual's inner life, didn't he?
Absolutely. He showed that subjective experience, especially the really intense stuff, isn't just fluff. It's real data about being human. It's about finding what genuinely feeds your soul, what transforms you for the better.
It really is a paradigm shift.
Yeah.
Still feels fresh today.
So here's something to think about, a final thought maybe.
Cool.
If the ultimate test of any belief system, any philosophy, is the impact it has on a life, what truth are you living by right now? And maybe more importantly, what fruits is it actually bearing in your life and in the lives of the people around you?
That's something to chew on.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acatra Foundation.